This is Groundwire, the bi-weekly newscast of Canada's National Campus and Community Radio Association. We're your hosts, Joel Bard
and Tara Lansley. Here are the headlines.
On Thursday, May 3rd, more than 100 Musqueam band members and supporters marched down Granville Street in Vancouver, assembling near the Marpole Midden, a stretch of land on South Marine Drive, which used to be one of the Musqueam Nation's most significant winter villages. A five-story commercial and residential development has been proposed for this piece of land. The Musqueam Nation maintains Aboriginal title and rights to the land, although the lot is held in fee simple by the developers. Archaeologists first found intact ancestral remains on the site in late January, and work was stopped in the immediate area where the remains were found, but developers were allowed to continue working in the surrounding lots. They halted work for a few weeks in March following protests and pickets on the site. During this halt, the Musqueam Nation, the property developers, the City of Vancouver, and the province of BC attempted to come to an agreement about what would happen on the Midden. Recently, in an open letter, the Musqueam offered to swap land with the private developer for nearby land, but they have not yet received a response from the developers or the provincial government on the proposal. The development work resumed in the area in April. This week, archaeologists turned up intact ancestral remains of two infants and another body. Speaking on behalf of the City of Vancouver, City Manager Penny Ballam says they're not permitted to withhold a building permit for archaeological issues, and the decision to pull the development permit will lie with the province. The Musqueam have stated their intention to occupy the site and halt development, and Union of BC Indian Chiefs Grand Chief Stuart Phillip announced that the site will remain shut down until the province is prepared to come to the table and discuss a resolution.
In the United Kingdom, on September 30, 2011, the jury for the mock trials of the companies operating the Athabasca oil sands in Alberta, Canada, found the CEOs guilty with a unanimous verdict. These are clips of Polly Higgins, also known as Earth's Lawyer.
We held a mock trial in the UK Supreme Court. It was as if the International Crime of Ecocide was already in place, then had been transposed into national legislation. So an Ecocide Act was drafted up. We had real judge, real jury, real legal teams prosecuting in defence. The only thing we couldn't get that was real were our CEOs. But the ecocides themselves were based on real evidence. And there were three charges of ecocide against two CEOs of big oil companies. Nothing was scripted, so we didn't know what the outcome would be. What happened was we ended up with two convictions. There were three charges. One was actually looking at the BP Gulf oil spill, and then the other two were the Athabasca tar sands. And the jury came back and were unanimous of convictions of guilt for the tar sands charges. They saw that this was mass damage and destruction. And obviously we had to narrow down the issues because it was just for one day. But it allowed us to do it in a way where we could sufficiently flag up various aspects and road test the legislation. What we did do was we looked at one particular species. We looked at birds and the adverse impact on birds of the Athabasca tar sands. It wasn't possible to look at many different stakeholder groups. So we had a prosecuting team and we had a defending team. The prosecuting team, their client was the Earth, recognising the Earth's right to life. Now, it isn't just on the territory, the land itself, but can have huge ramifications for the whole of the world. And in fact, it's also about creating a number one overriding duty that supersedes that duty that we have at the moment to put profit first. In fact, if anything, what it says is about putting people and planet first. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, destroy our Earth, we destroy our right to peaceful enjoyment of the Earth. Throughout history, times when civilization gets to a certain point where we say the moral imperative trumps the economic imperative.
May 5th is Stop the Tar Sands Day. For more information, you can visit tarsandsaction.org, naturecanada.ca, and for the full interview, you can visit wings.org. This is Tara Lansley at CGSF, Burnaby, BC.
The Conservatives' decision to pass legislation to squash the National Gun Registry was controversial in its own right. The bill, called C-19, passed on April 5th. It calls for the destruction of existing records on gun ownership, and it does away with laws that require gun sellers to keep records of their sales and verify firearms licenses. The province of Quebec has succeeded in filing an injunction to stop the federal government from destroying the records on the grounds that they are an asset to law enforcement. Quebec's opposition to the bill has garnered a lot of attention, but that of another group hasn't. Women's groups unanimously oppose the destruction of the National Gun Registry, and they are upset that they were shut out from testifying at the Senate Committee on Legal and Constitutional Affairs. The committee debated the dismantling of the registry in the weeks prior to the passing of the bill. Paulette Senior is the CEO of YWCA Canada. She says that YWCA crisis workers unanimously opposed the dismantling of the bill. She said, quote, "This bill seriously weakens the ability of police to remove weapons from men who pose a threat to their families, and it makes it much easier for them to purchase long guns with fake or invalid licenses. This is a very dangerous change for the women we serve."
A Maple Ridge, BC man is calling for a public inquiry into the last federal election. In an 8-minute YouTube video called "Vote Moving: Canadian Election Fraud," Stephen Bryant lays out a case for how the Conservative government could have won a majority government rather than a minority government because of vote moving. Vote moving is a process in which voters vote outside of their riding of ordinary residence.
What we're suggesting is that in an effort to optimize their vote, people took their votes in ridings where they knew it was going to be a blowout, and they placed that vote in another riding which was going to be a swing riding or a dead heat.
This act is illegal, but Bryant says that the safeguards against it are easy to subvert. You can vote in a riding by producing a passport and a utility bill. Passports don't feature a person's address, and Bryant says that people could easily fabricate a utility bill and that many people have secondary houses. Bryant's call for a public inquiry into vote moving in the 2007 election has gained the support of Kennedy Stewart, an NDP MP for Burnaby Douglas. Bryant's YouTube video is getting more views since the robocall controversy. This interview was conducted by Nina Halliday. For Groundwire, I'm Frieda Worden.
You're listening to Groundwire, news from Canadian Community Radio.
Next are features.
The downtown east side of Vancouver has long been recognized as Canada's poorest postal code, but the developers and the municipal government of Vancouver are creating a wave of gentrification that threatens to displace most, if not all, of its residents. Nick Panu recorded some of the protesters for Groundwire.
My traditional name is Gwent Gattle. I'm at Gwent, but you can call me Herb.
Why are we going to build $250,000 condos right here in the heart of the downtown east side when people here are worried about where their next meal is going to come from?
That's right.
We need to put a halt on building condos down here until there's not a single person living in SROs.
That's right.
Living on the street and living on the shelter.
If we can go back to that point in time a few months ago, that was a big blow to this community because that development is happening right in the heart of the downtown east side.
Yeah, the Pantages used to be a theater, I believe. I can't remember exactly what it used to be, but it got torn down and they want to build condo units starting at like $250,000 a piece. And this is just a stone's throw from the Carnegie Center. And just the rate of change in this neighborhood, especially in regards to the higher income people coming in, it's really alarming because they're not replacing much, if any, of the low income or social housing units that are being converted into micro lofts, I think is the new term.
You know, when developers buy a building, the renovations they make to increase their rents. Can you give an example? Like I think we were talking before about how the renovations can be very minimal, just maybe fixing up the floor a little bit. You know, some broken hinges, but they can jack up the just by doing those little things. They can jack up the rent by $100, $150. And can you talk a little bit about the changes happening in your building, the York, just down the street?
Well, in the York, they've renovated the bathrooms, which is actually a good thing. They put new flooring in. They're putting new fridges in. Gave us these fob keys. They're these little electronic devices where you just push the button and the door unlocks itself. And they're going to be charging us $50 if we lose that. So if I'm paying $475 a month for rent, and then I lose my key, and I got to pay that $50, I'm going to be down to $80 to live off of for that month. It's little things like that that make it really hard for the low-income people in the neighborhood to... There is rent protections in place for particular tenants. I can't remember the exact figures, but they can't raise my rent more than 4% a year, I think. But I can move out tomorrow. My rent is 4.25. I can move out tomorrow. Someone can move in next week, and there's no protection between tenants. So the new owner can jack it up to 600, 700, 800, whatever he feels is justifiable with the renovations they've made. The only thing that gentrifying this neighborhood is going to do is going to push us out to Surrey. It's going to push us out to West, New West and all that. Yeah, it's already happening.
I think they should push us to North Van, yeah. To West Van.
I mean, you know, despite
British properties.
Despite the issues of addiction, the issues of mental health down here, there is a tremendous sense of community. You can see it right here, right? What other communities out there do you see that band together like this? You know? So, it's not in our culture to be like this. It's just the situation we're in, right?
There will not be a single condo development that opens up in this neighborhood without a fight! That's right! That is going to be buying these condo developments. Let it be known that you will not sleep in peace.
That was Nick Panu of CJSF reporting from Vancouver's downtown east side.
Heading east now to Thunder Bay, here's Jason Wellwood with a story about Lakehead University students.
On the phone with me right now is Emma Brightwell, the new president of the Lakehead University Student Union. The Lakehead University Student Union announced on Thursday, April 29th, that it would be filing a lawsuit against the Board of Governors of Lakehead University. And here is Emma to tell us about it.
What initially happened was on January 27th, the Lakehead University Board of Governors voted to change their conflict of interest bylaw. And what they did is they changed the wording in that members of the board could not have a different interest from, it used to say society as a whole, and they changed it to the board as a whole. And in doing this, they essentially said that students are in a direct conflict with anything that involved student issues, including tuition, and they gave an example that students were not allowed to vote on the issue of tuition at the upcoming tuition vote. They weren't allowed to take part in the discussion, they weren't allowed to ask any questions, they weren't allowed to give any input, and they were not allowed to make the vote. With that happening, we contacted our lawyer, and we ended up drafting a letter that said, this is what we're interpreting your bylaw as. Is this what is going on? And if so, can we discuss a way that we could kind of work together to resolve this issue? And they essentially said, no, go away. So we sent them an MOU, which is a Memorandum of Understanding. We said, we're hoping to work together on you with this issue. If you do not get back to us by a certain date, then we will have to go to the courts. And they again told us to go away. So Thursday, we broke it to the media that this was happening. Friday was the vote, and in a kind of change of plans, the Board of Governors allowed the students, or they passed a motion to suspend their conflict of interest bylaw pending an internal review of the bylaw. So they would do an internal review themselves of the bylaw and decide whether it needed changes or what changes they were going to do to it. And so this meant that the student governors were still able to stay in the meeting and to vote on the issue of tuition. So right now, we actually really consider this a pretty good victory for us. We are going to proceed cautiously, though. We have to see what the board decides, whether they decide to change anything on the conflict of interest bylaw. We have sent them a letter that says, if you do decide to do this again, or if you do not change anything within the conflict of interest bylaw as it stands now, we will not hesitate to send our application to the courts. So with no notice, we will send it to the courts. They know what wall they're going to be facing if they do decide to not change anything and leave it as is. We've also started a petition to open the Lakehead University Act to enshrine student positions on any governing body of the or of Lakehead University. And we had our first 120 signatures presented to the Legislative Assembly of Ontario yesterday at around 3:30. Our petition is still ongoing, and as we collect the signatures, we're sending them into the Legislative Assembly.
Once again, that was Emma Brightwell, the president of the Lakehead University Student Union. And for more information on the Lakehead University Student Union, please feel free to log on to lusu.ca. This is Jason Wellwood reporting for CILU in Thunder Bay and Groundwire.
You can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union.
May 1st was May Day, a day to celebrate workers' rights around the globe. This year in Canada, many large and small labor organizations were out in force side by side with Canadian Occupy groups and representatives of many other issues. Leanne Arneson interviewed two arts organizers about their May Day plans.
With recent announcements of budget cuts to arts and culture organizations in Canada, the theme of austerity measures from the federal and Ontario government were present in this year's May Day celebrations, especially in Canada's capital city. A Solidarity Against Austerity march was organized in Ottawa, where roughly 1,000 people representing government workers, labor activists, and members of Occupy Ottawa marched from Confederation Park to the PM's office to protest Harper's new budget. Shelley Bird, a union activist and worker with the Canadian Union of Public Employees, CUPE.
We see tomorrow as a starting point of bringing a broad range of groups and organizations and people together in Ottawa tomorrow and beyond to begin to build a strong and unified resistance against austerity, against cuts to public programs and services that our community relies on, cuts to jobs that our community relies on and people living in our community. So we see that it's time for us to work across our various interests because we're all being impacted by the Harper government austerity agenda in many different ways.
In Quebec, a province-wide student strike is currently going into its 13th week, with daily demonstrations of striking students and their supporters taking place on the streets of Montreal. May Day celebrations this year were fueled and powered by the student movement. The anti-capitalist May Day celebrations began in the evening when students, labor groups, and anti-capitalist activists gathered at Metro Champ-de-Mars, the location of Montreal's first May Day protest, organized by the Anti-Capitalist Convergence of Montreal, CLAC. Marie-Ève Lemay, who CLAC speaks with CKUT's Aaron Leacock.
The May Day demonstrations around the world comes from a clear tradition of revolutionary, anti-capitalist, and internationalist tradition. So we wanted to bring that back more to the public, mm-hmm. I say.
In Toronto, the May Day March was organized by No One Is Illegal Toronto, Occupy Toronto, and the May 1st Movement, a coalition of over 40 community groups. MayWorks Events, a yearly festival which celebrates art and culture and the working class, takes place starting May 5th.
MayWorks kind of straddles the labor movement and the artist movement, cultural kind of movement, and we find ourselves within this position really trying to promote and kind of forefront cultural activity. We see culture and art as being necessary, and they're actually very present and at the forefront of various social movements. In terms of cuts to funding, MayWorks, like so many other arts organizations, has felt these cuts. It's something we've, you know, fight back in trying to fundraise in our strong belief that these are important festivals, that art is important. We really hope to be fighting back and successfully winning back these spaces where we're able to forefront our works and the politics of our works. MayWorks really tries to carve out a space for such groups to promote and to share what their work does, which is really combine various social movements, whether it's affordable living or affordable food, accessible space, whatever these issues are, we really try to carve out a space where groups can bring their issues to the forefront through artistic means.
Thanks to Leanne Arneson of CKUT Radio Montreal and to Claire-Claude Wren for the YouTube video of Wren playing Union Maid in Vancouver on May Day. Speaking of arts.
Yes, speaking of arts. A unique musical organization just concluded its 10th anniversary. The artistic directors and chief administrator of the Vancouver Intercultural Orchestra talked with producer Elizabeth Bay.
There is a great interest on the level of musicians and composers and listeners to look to see what can be learned and integrated from other cultures, because we have an incredible opportunity, unprecedented one in the world today, with global communications.
Vico is probably, we think, the only ensemble of its kind in Canada, and one of the only ensembles in the world that is creating intercultural music on an orchestral scale, on a large ensemble scale. We have about 25 members now.
Well, the Vancouver Intercultural Orchestra's roster is made up of musicians who have all kinds of other groups and bands and so on. Musicians are notorious for belonging to, you know, seven different ensembles every year. These ensembles, some of them are intercultural themselves, and they do really fine work. There's the Orchid Ensemble, they're a trio, Red Chamber, Kereshme, Silk Road, of course.
Which is Chushan Andre.
Chushan Andre. They've worked with us many times.
We had a duo from Japan, American-Japanese. Yeah. They actually don't have a name, but it was Curtis Patterson and Bruce Hubner.
Yeah,
and they played together for many years.
Koto and Shakuhachi.
We've had some soloists playing just solo pieces on our programs. The thing about it is that there's never enough money, but the good thing about it is that when you do grants, you are learning to connect with the society around you. The grants are for specific purposes, not just giving people money, but for themes and quality and very kinds of specific use or specific time period. That actually helps us connect into the community. That, I think, is quite rewarding.
The logistical challenges are severe, and it's things that a lot of other ensembles, regular Western ensembles, probably don't even think about anymore because they figured out how to do all those things, but we're kind of working it out as we go.
Radio is the art gallery of music. The closing of the CBC Orchestra, for instance, really was the closing of the National Art Gallery of Music. The educational part, we quickly realized that's a big part of the whole situation. Every step we take, there's something we need to learn. Because it's not really been done like this, and certainly not documented that we can find, The education is for everyone. The musicians are learning about each other's culture and incredibly different ways of playing the same thing. I think a lot of them are completely delighted. It isn't really an ego thing at this point. It's very lovely that way. As we go along, we're gathering materials, we have public things. We also, the workshops that we've done in the last 3 years, 4 years, have really been well supported, but I think they do enjoy it. We're finding things that connect people as well, and not just the differences. And that also is every bit as important, because that dispels the myths that we can't do it because it's never been done.
And I think people find it inspiring as well, just to see all those people, all these musicians from different communities and different traditions working together to create something that's beautiful and that's artistically effective, that doesn't erase their individual identities. It really celebrates the differences.
Thanks to Elizabeth Bay of CJSF for her piece about the Vancouver Intercultural Orchestra. She spoke to artistic directors Moshe Denberg and Mark Arminini and chief administrator Melanie Thompson.
Now here's Jordan Mitchell with the Groundwire Community Radio Report.
April 21st was Record Store Day. The original idea was conceived in 2007, a celebration of the unique culture surrounding over 700 independently owned record stores in the USA and Canada, as well as hundreds of similar stores internationally. In Vancouver, CJSF and CITR celebrated Record Store Day this year by teaming up to do a live on-location broadcast from Neptune, Red Cat, Scratch, Zulu, Beat Street, and Vinyl Records.
Hi, we're the Valentines.
You said happy Record Store Day, guys.
This is Tara from CJSF, and I'm with Rob Frith, the owner of Neptune Records. Say hello.
Hello.
And it is Record Store Day. Now, as an owner of an independent record store, what does this day mean to you?
It means that, traditionally now, the last 5 years, that it becomes our busiest day of the year. It's better than Christmas or anything else. And it's just a fun day. Like, people come in there, trying to get those releases that only come out that day, and then... And just hang out, listen to music, and just be with a whole lot of people that are into the same thing they are, music.
And so, Jacob, right behind you is Nardwar.
And we're live?
We're live.
We're live right now. Do you know what station we are?
We're on CJSF and CITR. And I'm here at Neptune Records in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Just saw the Ballantines playing, part of Record Store Day. The Apollo Ghosts, I think, are on right now, Red Cat. Earlier, I saw Lady Hawk. Walked in to Neptune here, and Rob from Neptune gave me the special backstage pass. Yes, there's a backstage pass at Neptune Records. Underneath, Rob, is like a secret area where they're serving cheese and all sorts of meat stuff.
I'm Q Courtney, and I play drums and sing in the Courtneys.
All right, well, I'm Classic Courtney, and I'm the only real Courtney in the band. And I play guitar, and I also play in bitch moves.
This piece had interviews from Tara Lansley, Kyra Shibley, Amanda McCauley, Duncan McHugh, Sarah Cordingly, and was produced by Sarah Buchanan and Jordan Mitchell.
Doot doot a loot doo!
Doot doot! Groundwire is a project of National Campus and Community Radio Association, a coalition of more than 80 volunteer-led stations across Canada.
This episode of Groundwire was produced at CJSF, the campus community radio station at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, BC.
Thanks to Frieda Worden for her help with this edition.
CJSF congratulates the Groundwire National Coordinators on their excellent volunteer work, keeping the program coming out every 2 weeks, year-round.
If you'd like to contribute to Groundwire as a reporter, producer, or donor, please visit the website groundwire.ncra.ca for more details.